I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, what might a Mormon president mean to the U.S.? We'll hear from a critic and a believer. But first, President Bush is visiting New Orleans and Mississippi's Gulf Coast region today, his first visit since the one-year anniversary of Katrina. He hopes to focus on education and will visit a charter school, but in so doing, he'll also highlight how many schools are closed. Coleman Warner is a reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. And Coleman, how many schools are open there?
Well, in New Orleans itself, in Orleans Parish, you have 56 public schools open today, and that's about half of the total number of public schools in the parish before the storm. Most of the other parishes have reopened virtually all of their schools. Most of the other parishes, even the parochial schools, are back open.
New Orleans just celebrated Mardi Gras season last month. Did that provide maybe a little shot in the arm for at least businesses?
I think it did, and I think it, more importantly, it had provided a shot in the arm as to the perception of New Orleans and whether this is a good tourism city post-Katrina. And I believe it is absolutely a good tourism city, and that message got out.
But it is still tough for someone who lives there. The Brookings Institution comes out with a monthly assessment of the recovery efforts in New Orleans. It's called the Katrina Index. Tell us a little bit about what the index says about population growth, housing, some of those other issues for public transportation, issues for people who live there.
The index report of Brookings, as well as our own research here locally, show that population growth has been slow but steady in many of these areas. The big unanswered question is what will happen in the future in Orleans Parish. Housing remains a serious problem. The housing shortage is pretty severe in many parts of Orleans Parish and in some of the neighboring parishes. And so the Brookings, as well as other groups, have attracted some of the strains on the quality of life here. There are many infrastructure improvements that still need to be made.
Yeah, they say it's just inching along to recovery. But talking about some of the assistance for, say, home rebuilding, the president points to the fact that he had $110 billion approved in relief to the Gulf Coast. So far, $53 billion has been spent. State leaders say there's a holdup in getting funding to projects because of a requirement that says the state must pay 10% of the costs. How is that affecting the recovery there? Is that a good assessment of the situation? Because, some in the White House are saying, well, it's the local officials who are fouling things up.
Well, I think a lot of the delays have to do with bureaucratic procedure. And some of it's FEMA procedure, some of it is state government procedure. A lot of it is intended to prevent waste of public monies. And that's well-intentioned. But the cumulative effect of many of the regulations is that the monies don't trickle down to the needed projects very quickly.
Well, the new Democratic Congress has said they're going to cut through some red tape. We'll see if that happens. But I want to ask you quickly about the controversy over public housing. There's plans to knock down more older public housing buildings. People who live there said it's safe to live there. How's that controversy going?
It's a pretty hot button at this point. And some of the residents that were in those complexes want to come home, and they believe that those older complexes can be restored and cleaned up and put back into use. The federal policy or position on this is that has been that most of these complexes are badly outdated and need to come down and replaced with more mixed income types of developments. Yeah. So that remains a very hot issue.
Well, you know, Coleman, just in the seconds we have left, what's it like to live there?
I've heard a lot of people call it the big hard because the recovery process is not an easy element for everyday life. There's a strain on every institution and on every family to some degree. There are a lot of strains on everyday life here, but it's not a hopeless place to be either. It is a place that many of the residents who have roots here or long-time commitments here believe can recover fully if you take the long view and you just take things one day at a time.
Coleman Warner, a reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Coleman, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay.
A strategy blueprint from Mitt Romney's presidential campaign was leaked to the Boston Globe this week. It revealed that his advisors have concerns that his hair's too perfect, he's seen as a flip-flopper on social issues, and he's a Mormon. The Mormon faith was founded in 1820 by Joseph Smith, who said God visited him in upstate New York and told him that he, Smith, was the prophet who would restore the true church. The Church of Latter-day Saints, or Mormons, is now one of the world's fastest-growing faiths, with about 6 million followers in America and more than 12 million members worldwide. Mormons believe deeply in the family, in the return of Christ to earth. They abstain from smoking, alcohol, caffeine. They long ago repudiated polygamy. Ann Romney has said that she thinks her husband should give a JFK-type speech to teach voters about their faith, as then-candidate Kennedy did in 1960 when he reassured Americans that his Catholicism wouldn't mean that he'd take orders from the Pope. But author Damon Linker says the task for Mitt Romney is much harder. He says the more Americans educate themselves about Mormon theology, the more their concerns about a Mormon president will increase. Well, today we're going to speak with Linker and with a Mormon scholar of religion who disagrees with him to do what Ann Romney has asked, to try to learn about the Mormon faith. Damon Linker, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
You are a writer, spent 2 years as a visiting non-Mormon professor at Brigham Young University.
Yes.
You write, one of the main issues for Romney will be that unlike the Pope, who's not considered a prophet, but someone who's moved by the Spirit, the leaders of the Mormon Church, from Joseph Smith through Brigham Young down to the current leader, Gordon Hinckley, are considered prophets. Why is that important to you in this context?
It's true that all the monotheistic religions believe that their faiths are founded in prophecy, but all of them believe that the age of prophecy is past. Mormonism is different because it was founded by a prophet less than 200 years ago, and the Mormon Church has institutionalized prophecy because they have chosen to make the president of the Mormon Church a prophet by virtue of that office. So anyone who holds the position as president of the church is thought to be God's mouthpiece on earth.
Well, and you have concerns about that, maybe mouthpiece directly to the future president of the United States. But Richard Bushman, a Mormon historian, responded to your article and said it doesn't work like that. It's more like American law, that a judge could possibly throw out everything from the past, say segregation is a case of law. But most of the time, they just build on what already exists. And Bushman said prophets do the same. They just build on already existing prophecies, maybe add to them. And in fact, you even write that some of the most recent prophecies have moderated the church, getting rid of polygamy in the late 1800s and allowing blacks to become members of the church in the 1970s.
Yes, absolutely. That's true that since the death of Joseph Smith, prophecies by the head of the church have tended to be moderate and to bring the church into greater conformity with the American mainstream. It's also true, however, that if you take religion seriously as a practice that human beings have in devotion to the divine, then it is striking that Mormonism is distinct in its tendency to see religious authority coming from someone who is expected to speak with the authority of God himself. And so there's a way in which one cannot prejudge what a Mormon prophet will say. You can say all you want that over the last 180 years or so, the Mormon prophet hasn't done anything too far out. But the fact is that less than 200 years ago, this man named Joseph Smith created this religion out of nothingness. He came up with a series, a huge litany of revelations that no one had ever heard of before, claims about empirical history that no one had made previously, and asserted them, and you got this religion created, again, out of nothingness. And that shows that for the Mormons, prophecy is extremely important, and it's not possible to prejudge.
Let's talk about that. Founder Joseph Smith said that the angel Moroni told him where to find these tablets in upstate New York. He translated them. And this is the second major part of the point that you're trying to make. Joseph Smith said that the U.S. is part of sacred history. These are your words, sacred history, that the Garden of Eden was located in Missouri, for instance. In fact, the U.S. was created to allow the restoration to occur and the Mormon Church to spread a restored gospel. I mean, have I interpreted your words correctly?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what would be the problem with the U.S. being the focal point of some sort of future for Mormonism? How do you read that?
The Mormons believe that we are living, broadly speaking, toward the end of sacred history, shortly before the second coming of Christ. And they have a very literal view of Jesus Christ's return. They believe not only, like many evangelicals and Catholics, that when Christ returns, he'll do so in the Middle East. They believe that he might also come and rule the world from the territory of the United States. Now, maybe in the abstract that isn't a problem, but when you think that there might be a Mormon president sometime in the near future who might believe these things, it I think should raise very interesting questions and perhaps troubling questions about what would happen if some faction of the Mormon Church became convinced that Christ had already returned and was living in Missouri, for instance. Would Romney dismiss this, or is this something that he'd have to take very seriously? And really, if you think about it, if you're a devout believer in this, and this prophet says to do X, no matter how outlandish it might sound, who are you to say no? And again, then I think it's legitimate to ask someone running for president from this church, Mitt Romney, in this case, to say, okay, well, what would you do? And if you're going to tell me that you wouldn't obey such a command, on what basis wouldn't you obey the command? Are you not a devout believer in what your church teaches? What sources does your church have? Is it conscience? Is it that you receive your own different revelation?
Because you write that that Mormons don't have the traditions that other churches have for to have branches that might have dissent.
Yes. I mean, for instance, Catholics have natural law that a pious Catholic can use to reflect on something the Pope might say and say, well, this can't be genuinely what God wants because it conflicts with natural law. And you know, that doesn't settle things, but at least it's a tradition of dialectic and discussion and kind of self-criticism on the part of believers. Mormons, at least as yet, have not developed such a tradition.
Well, meanwhile, as you well know, some listeners are cringing. You know, religion is private. All faiths have elements that are inexplicable to people outside churches. As you yourself write, the Constitution stipulates that no religious test shall ever be required to any office under the United States. You know, many people still say that the anti-Catholicism that Kennedy had to address, that was a shameful part of our history. He shouldn't have had to answer those questions. What do you say to people who say, just even in talking about this, you know, we're violating something sacred?
The reason why Romney has to confront these questions is not so much because he's a Mormon as because he's trying to run as a candidate of the religious right. And it's the religious right that has tried to put religion at the core of politicians' beliefs and seeking of office and their identities. So if he could be like JFK and say, look, yes, I believe certain things that my church tells me to believe, but that doesn't matter because when I become president, my duties that are incumbent upon me and my office as president will supersede or override what my church might say, that would be fine. But he can't really say this because he's running as a Republican who wants to get the votes of the religious right. And the religious right then would say, well, then you're not one of us. Well, I would say that it's the religious right that wants religion to be at the core of our politics. But if that's true, then we as citizens are every bit entitled to ask tough, pointed questions about the faith of our politicians.
Damon Linker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Author Damon Linker, he wrote about the Mormon faith in the New Republic. Well, after a break, a Mormon responds. And by the way, did you know that Democrat Harry Reid is also a Mormon, as is Republican Orrin Hatch, or that Mormons attend chapels weekly, but they also have temples for rituals like marriage? They're normally closed to non-Mormons, but we took a tour of one, and we'll put that story on our website at here-now.org. Back after a quick break, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with our look at Mormonism in the wake of Mormon Mitt Romney's presidential run. And we want to turn quickly to Kathleen Flake. She's assistant professor of American religious history at Vanderbilt Divinity School and a practicing Mormon. And Kathleen, I know you want to respond to writer Damon Linker's claim that Mormons take orders from the head of the church because he is a prophet of God. What say you?
Well, I suppose my response would be that Mormonism is hard to understand, and many things look dangerous to us when we don't understand them very well. So if I were to try to shed some light on that as an insider, first of all, you need to understand that prophecy as it operates in Mormonism operates within a system of checks and balances. Individuals are trained to ask whether anything that anybody else says in this system is true or not, and to believe that God will tell them whether or not it is true. And so if Gordon Hinckley makes a request upon the membership to do a particular thing, and if anyone in that membership disagrees, they are required to go ascertain for themselves whether or not it's revelation. Now, you can talk psychologically about how the system also sets people up to follow, but then that's where we have to look at how people actually act in this system. I suppose mostly what I want to say about Mr. Linker is he's got a hard case to bring here. He's got no evidence.
Well, and others agree with you that there's no evidence that Harry Reid, Orrin Hatch, Bob Bennett, Tom Udall took their orders from the prophet of the Mormon Church. But what about the role of the U.S.? And as he said, the patriotism or, you know, feelings about the U.S. flow directly from Mormon theology. In other words, that the U.S. has been created to advance Mormon theology.
It's absolutely true that the Constitution was viewed as an inspired document. The Constitution should not be conflated with the political entity that is the United States in Mormon thought. And indeed, when Smith spoke about Zion being established, it was in the Americas, it was the North American continent. He believed that the Western Hemisphere was a chosen site, hence the Book of Mormon story is a story of the Western Hemisphere. But Smith understood Zion to be the North American continent.
Well, you mentioned the Book of Mormon, and that gives us a good opportunity to ask you some of the questions that people are asking about the Mormon faith. So do you, if you don't mind, I was just going to ask, you know, go through, I hate to say it, but sort of the lightning round. Go through some of those to take advantage of your expertise right now. Do Mormons believe the Bible is the only word of God, or is the Book of Mormon and our other Mormon scriptures equal?
Smith said that he believed that the Bible was the word of God, and this is an article of faith among Mormons, that the Bible is the word of God insofar as it's translated correctly. The second dimension of this issue for Mormons, to which American Christians do not agree and still find an anathema, is that Mormons believe that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God. And open canon, I would say that that's probably the distinctive feature of Mormonism, that they believe in open canon.
Meaning what, that it's still ongoing?
They believe in modern revelation.
Do Mormons believe that God has an actual physical body?
Yes, they do.
Do Mormons believe, as we read, that only men can be anointed priests? Women can't go to the highest levels of heaven without being married to a man, and that we read, in fact, at marriage, women are given a nickname so that her husband can pull her through to heaven, can recognize her.
That's kind of a garbled view.
Pick it apart. Tease it apart.
Yeah. First of all, the stricture that individuals can only obtain the highest degree of glory in the afterlife through marriage applies equally to males and females, those who are married. Secondly, the kind of priesthood you see exercised in Mormon chapels, which resembles what you see in Protestantism and Catholicism, that is held by males. The kind of priesthood that you see operating in temples, that's held by males and females.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that the thinking is that a Mormon man will receive his own planet, which he will then run, and it'll be populated by celestial beings provided by his wife?
This gets to probably the chief difficulty with most Christians understanding Mormon Christianity. Mormons believe the object of this life is to become like God. And for Mormons, God is understood in terms of parenting. Generally speaking, a parent is one who has the capacity to engender in others the same quality of life that the parent has, right? So when Latter-day Saints speak of God, they understand God as that kind of parent in all its dimensions.
And he lives on his own planet, do I understand, Kolob, in this physical being, and so is that doesn't sound like a metaphorical goal for Mormons. It is a true goal to be.
It is a true goal.
Yes.
It's a concrete goal. If Mormons achieve what they believe the objective of their existence is, they will receive by divine gift the capacity to engender divine life in others, not just physical life, but divine life as well.
Professor, for time, we have only been able to touch on just a couple of elements. I'm hoping we can talk to you again, first of all. And secondly, I'm wondering, how do you feel that this interest in Mormonism on the part of Americans because of Mitt Romney's run, how do you feel this is going to affect the religion?
Oh, I think the more people know about Mormonism, the less problem they have with it.
Do you really? I mean, we were just talking about planets. As you well know, talk radio is talking about the undergarments that many Mormon men wear when they get to the high level of priesthood. You know, are these kinds of things going to be a relief to Mormons that people know this now? Or is it, I don't know, is it going to be unsettling to what's been a very private faith?
I think it will be settling insofar as the conversation is an intelligent one, so that when the undergarments are spoken of, they're spoken of in the same way that people talk about clerical collars, or they talk about Jewish prayer shawls or, you know, yarmulkes, that this religion has clothing with a symbolic function. So I don't think that these things are a problem if the discussion is meant to illuminate, not frighten people.
Well, thanks so much for helping us make a start at that today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kathleen Flake is assistant professor of American religious history at Vanderbilt Divinity School and a practicing Mormon. Again, Professor Flake, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
To be continued, to be sure. Still ahead, a new study shows no connection between immigrants and high crime. That's right after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Quick, when I say large groups of immigrants moving into town, you say what? Well, polls show many Americans say higher crime. In fact, you might remember the town of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, passed an ordinance barring illegal immigrants from renting homes or working there. But according to a new study, immigrant men, legal and illegal, have an incarceration rate 5 times lower than the native-born population. And according to the study's co-author, the problem of crime in American society today is overwhelmingly a problem of natives, not immigrants. The study is distributed by the Immigration Policy Center. It was independently written. Co-author Ruben Rumbaut is sociology professor at the University of California, Irvine, and he joins us now. And Professor, give us your headline on this study.
There are two main points, I guess, that can come from the study in terms of specific findings. One is that in the last 15 years, the United States has seen the highest level of immigration ever of newcomers to the United States, both legal and illegal. And during that same period of time, crime rates in the United States, both violent crimes and property crimes, have dropped, and in fact, in some specific cases, have dropped to the lowest level ever recorded. Violent crimes overall have dropped to the lowest level ever recorded by 2005, and rates of homicide, assaults, robberies, burglaries, etc., have gone down as well.
And so even though there's more immigrants coming to the country, the rate of crime has dropped. But what did you find when you studied immigrants of every ethnic group who've been incarcerated?
Right, because during the same period, incarceration rates have been going up, and in fact, the U.S. incarceration rate is now the highest in the world. It has quadrupled from about 500,000 people in prisons and jails in the United States in 1980 to well over 2 million today.
By the way, I'll jump in to say that might be an argument for some who would say that incarceration cuts crime. What does the incarceration say to you about immigrant groups?
It turned out that the rate of incarceration for natives was 3.5% among young men 18 to 39, but among the foreign-born, it was less than 0.7%. And those rates were especially low for the Mexicans, Guatemalans, and Salvadorans, foreign-born, who are precisely the groups that predominate among the undocumented immigrant population.
Well, Ruben, let me jump in to ask you a couple of things some people might be thinking. First of all, what would you say in response to someone who might say, well, if these are illegal immigrants, they're off the radar, so they're less likely to be caught for crimes they might be committing and less likely to end up in jail? And you studied, you know, the jail population, but you're saying, what, there's not some large number of unsolved crimes that people are attributing to illegals?
Take the crime of homicide, for example. That is not something that goes, quote, under the radar. And studies of homicide, especially in border cities with very high numbers of immigrants, both legal and illegal, such as El Paso and San Diego in Miami, and in areas of high immigrant concentration like Los Angeles and in Chicago and New York, homicide rates have plummeted during the period of time that the immigrant population has been increasing significantly. So this is something that we have observed not just now, here and now, but something that goes back over 100 years government commissions in 1901, 1911, 1931, who were predisposed to find some link between immigration and criminality, were surprised to find exactly the opposite, which is what we have also been finding out in study after study over the past 30 years.
That, in fact, as you said, the rate of crime is lower among immigrant populations, whether they're illegal or legal immigrant populations.
That's correct.
One of the numbers from your study, men of Mexican descent, for instance, 0.7% of those foreign-born were
correct.
Incarcerated compared to 5.9% of native-born. That's an amazing comparison.
For every single nationality without exception, for every group, from Latin America, every group from Asia, the rates of the foreign-born were significantly lower than those of the U.S.-born.
Well, and that brings us to an interesting paradox that's in your study, something you call a paradox of assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
Higher crime rates for second- and third-generation immigrants.
By the second and third generation, they're no longer immigrants. They're born in the United States, they're U.S. citizens, they're thoroughly Americanized and acculturated. They speak English, and usually English only, and they are completely oriented to American life.
Including crime, apparently.
Exactly, including overweight, obesity. I mean, there are all sorts of things about American life that are great, and that's what attracts immigrants here. And on the whole, part of their assimilation process does follow that linear trajectory to English acquisition, more education, higher earnings, home ownership rates, and so on. But on the other hand, and that's where the paradox comes in, there are other trajectories that for a segment of this population, not for all of them, but for a segment of this population, leads to what we sometimes have called downward assimilation. And it does get them, if you will, assimilate the criminal propensities of the native-born.
So where do you think this perception comes from, this stereotype comes from, that immigrants, especially illegal immigrants, are responsible for higher crime rates, that, you know, it's the old there goes the neighborhood?
The perception of there goes the neighborhood is, of course, not limited only to immigrants or to today's immigrants. It is a natural response that you will find in any community whenever they absorb a very large number of strangers who differ from them in language, in the way they look. There's a perception of threat, and all the more in the United States after 9/11, in a climate of fear, with a war on terror, and a discussion in the media that often talks about the war on terror and undocumented immigration in the same breath. These myths and these stereotypes have always been with the United States since its founding, and you see them exacerbated during periods of high immigration. It happened with the Irish and the Jews and the Italians, and now it's happening with the Mexicans and others.
Well, do we understand that your study also points to words from President Bush?
That's true. In his major speech to the nation on immigration, that was a phrase in his speech that illegal immigration brings crime to our communities. But that is something that is repeated like a mantra. If you get on talk radio, I've been doing a number of interviews lately in Phoenix and Denver and places like that. And the perception is pervasive that the problems of crime must be caused by illegal.
I was wondering, do people say to you, no way? I mean, I just don't believe your numbers.
Right. It's a faith-based perception that is very difficult to shake. You can show them 100 years of evidence to the contrary, and they will persist in believing that it must not be so. There must be something wrong with the data. There must be something. The immigrants must be going under the radar. They just cannot accept the evidence at face value, because to accept it would mean then to have to change a much larger belief system that goes with it.
Professor Rumbaut, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure being with you.
Ruben Rumbaut, sociology professor at the University of California, Irvine, co-author of an independent study that claims immigration, whether illegal or legal, does not drive up crime rates in communities. That study is distributed by the Immigration Policy Center. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, still to come before we go, a story of immigration from a different era told in a new film called Sweetland, a tale about a German mail-order bride and her Minnesota farmer husband confronting love and bigotry in post-World War America. It is beautiful. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, this week, investigations into the use of illegal performance-enhancing substances such as steroids and human growth hormone took a new turn as federal agents raided two pharmacies Tuesday in Orlando, Florida, that might have been supplying sports figures as well as others with these substances. Joining us to talk about that raid and the rest of the news from the world of sports, Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, good to talk to you as always, but I don't know, is good or bad news for sports?
Bad news too often, isn't it?
Yeah. What makes this raid so significant?
Well, one thing that makes it significant is the size. There are millions and millions of dollars worth of illegal or illegally prescribed drugs involved here. Another is the scope. We've got at least four states involved. Once the internet comes into the picture, normal boundaries don't make much sense anymore. We've got doctors buying drugs with personal credit cards, which is a fairly unusual circumstance. The Pittsburgh Steelers have been implicated in the sense that one of the seven doctors associated with the team has been implicated in this investigation. And I think the other thing that makes it significant is the people running the investigation appear to be saying, look, we're not going to give you a lot of headliners. We're not going to give you celebrity names. We're just as concerned with the fact that they're high school athletes, college athletes, and citizens of whom you've never heard who were involved in this.
The guy at the gym. Okay. Well, there was also news this week that the National Football League's Players Association is trying to clean up their image, proposing a three strikes, you're out crime policy. So what would that involve?
It's a little bit early to know what it would involve. It's a bit vague. So far, it sounds to me like a public relations campaign because people are understandably a little bit upset about the number of NFL players who get arrested at 2:30 in the morning outside nightclubs having shot off guns.
Yes. And
so that, you want to clean up your act. You want people to feel better about the people they're watching on TV each Sunday afternoon. The specifics really haven't been, hammered out yet, and so I don't know.
Right. No more. Well, staying with the more serious sports news, we want to talk to you about a story we spoke about a few weeks back. It's the Baltimore Sun reporting this week that Dr. Elliot Pelman, the head of the NFL's Research Committee on Concussions, resigned Monday. This, as concussions and the long-term effects they've had on players have been so much in the news, the suicide of former Philadelphia Eagles player Andre Waters, allegations by former New England Patriot Ted Johnson that his memory loss and depression linked to multiple concussions. So what do you make of this quitting by Dr. Pelman?
Well, Dr. Pelman has been under some fire and some scrutiny for a fair amount of time. There's a real conflict of interest built into this. It's very hard to say you're a doctor working on behalf of your patients and also be employed by the National Football League or by a particular team in the league. There's a conflict of interest built into that. But this particular fellow has been implicated and accused in the past of claiming that concussion was not a serious problem and his studies were limited to active players. Well, active players, being still active, don't show too many symptoms of brain damage, whereas 10 years later, 5 years later, in Ted Johnson's case, only just a few years later, they do show serious symptoms of damage as a result of playing in the football in the NFL. And this guy simply said, well, there's no evidence. Well, there's no evidence because he didn't look for it. You don't find it if you don't look for it.
Well, he's now gone, so things might change at the NFL. Well, we need a mood shift, I think. So let's play some sound from ESPN's broadcast of a University of Tennessee men's game Tuesday night. A surprise visitor, the women's coach, singing the school's fight song, Rocky Top. Roll it.
Rocky Top, you already home sweet home to me. Rocky Top, Tennessee.
So, Pat Summitt can coach, but can she sing?
How can American Idol not be the next stop? That's the only question. Pat is a piece of work. She really is. The men's coach at Tennessee showed up at a women's game, shirtless, painted orange, cheering for the women's team. Pat gave him a big kiss, said, I'll be at the men's game, and I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. She not only sang Rocky Top, she dressed up as a cheerleader, which is what she used to be many years ago, and led cheers and got on top of the pyramid, the cheerleader pyramid. It was great video. God bless her. Pat's always been one of my favorites.
All the school officials are saying, no, don't let her fall, because she's one of the winningest coaches in the sport.
The winning. Nobody closed.
Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield, covers sports and a whole lot more. Catch his show every weekend. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 17 years ago, Minnesotan Ali Salim read a story that captivated him. A gravestone made of wheat told of the abiding bond between a Norwegian farmer and his mail-order bride.
Yeah, over not the for me to meet him on the hormo. Yeah, I got to step on myself, see the creaking. All of you are obrieved, out of bed. Out of bed, good at Franzen? Nine.
Sure you want to marry this one?
The film the story inspired is called Sweetland, Salim's first feature after a decade of making commercials. It's a simple, beautifully shot tale of love and the American immigrant experience from the 1920s to the present. It was shot in 24 days for an astonishing $1 million. It just received the Independent Spirit Award for Best First Feature. And director Ali Salim joins us from Los Angeles with more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I first heard about your film when I was at a wedding in Minnesota. And people there embraced this as their story, and I understand helped you make it in many ways.
We did shoot the film in Montevideo, Minnesota, which is a town of 5,000 on the South Dakota border, and people came out in droves to support us with, you know, everybody seems to have a restored Model T, and they would stop and ask us how much it would cost to get their car in our movie. And naturally, we didn't charge them, but... Another day we had like a harvest sequence where we needed hundreds of extras in period clothing, and they all show up in their own period clothing. So, I mean, with a $1 million budget, I don't think we could have made this anywhere else, because when Hollywood makes a movie like this, they just throw money at it, and well, we didn't have the money to throw.
But it also made it look so accurate. Help us set the scene. It's around the 1920s. The lovely Inga has just arrived in this small Minnesota town with her few bags, her hopes, and her very little English. She's carrying her beloved gramophone, and she's picked up at the train station by two men. The more gregarious, by the way, is the great actor Alan Cummings, also a producer of the film. She's a mail-order bride. First of all, how common was this in that time in that area?
I can't give you a statistic, but there was a lot of this going on with farmers who had come to, you know, make a livelihood and then sent home for women, because there weren't that many, and there certainly weren't that many in these small towns where they were existing.
Inga realizes that the quiet, stoical Olaf is actually her betrothed. He discovers that she is actually German, which provokes memories. You know, the Germans were the enemies. There was a bitterly fought war. The local minister refuses to marry the two of them. We have a scene here where Inga's applications for papers in order to get married from the town judge is met with derision from the town clerk. Let's listen.
Anyways, the judge says we have to be careful about this sort of thing.
What sort of thing?
German nationals engage in prostitution. They encourage polygamy. They harbor dangerous political convictions. Are you aware of the Espionage Act of 1916?
You think she's a spy?
Well, I'll tell you what's in her favor. She's not Chinese.
I've read, half Arab of Egyptian descent, first generation American.
Correct.
How did this small-town bigotry slash fears resonate with you?
My father's an Egyptian immigrant from the middle 50s, and I think a lot of Inga's assimilating comes out of watching my dad find his way to being an American and yet hanging on to who he was. And then, you know, obviously since 9/11, just my name, even though my mother's German and I look more like my mother, just my name alone gets some eyebrows raised at the airports and things like that. And so I've experienced a little bit of that, you know, that kind of tension that an immigrant would feel.
Well, meanwhile, your characters, Inga and Olaf, are shunned. They form this achingly formal relationship. She moves into his house. He moves into the barn. They harvest their fields alone, backbreaking work, all set against an achingly beautiful landscape, the lone farmhouse, a small church, windswept waves of grain. Everything feels so authentic.
It's a combination of the amount of time that I had from when I first read the short story until I had the money to shoot. I had a lot of time to hang out at the Minnesota Historical Society and look at pictures, and I had a lot of time to drive through the Midwest, location scouting, but really just meeting people and hearing their stories. It has a lot to do with the town, Montevideo, and their belief that this had to be their story, which I think makes it more authentic.
Well, part of what might have resonated with people in that area is one of the farms in the story gets auctioned off, and there's a character they call the socialist. He's trying to organize the other farmers as their friend's farm goes on the block. Let's listen.
Look at that. They're auctioning the baby's crib.
And at this time, I'll turn it over to Palmer, and he'll give you the specifics on the property. Well, as many of you know...
Look at the suit this guy's wearing. Look at the suit. Any of you guys own a suit like that?
Condition of this mortgage.
All right, how many kids does he have?
He's got nine kids.
Nine kids.
Thank you, Palmer. We're ready to start the auction.
That's a socialist. Get him out of here.
And I got 2,000. About 2,100.
Where does this story intersect with Minnesota history?
The socialists in Minnesota at the time were doing these penny auctions where they would go to these foreclosures, farm foreclosures, and block out the gentleman bidders and only bid a penny for the farm. And they would never raise the bid. And I had those scenes written in, and they just didn't play. Nobody believed them. It felt sort of Disney-like, you know, like, oh, isn't that great? They bought it for a penny and their friend has it.
Well, eventually Olaf, because of deep love for his friend, the farmer, who is having his farm auctioned off, enters the bidding. Everyone looks on surprise. Let's listen.
5,500. Do I hear that correctly? 5,500.
5,750.
6,000.
6,200.
7,000.
Bidding stands at 7,000. Do I hear any more bids at 71? 71. 7,071. 71. Sold 7,000. Gentleman right here. Give me your name, please.
Olaf Tarvik. I don't have $7,000.
I know. This act of friendship redeems the couple in the eyes of the community. The church comes forward with the money to help him buy his friend's farm. The story fast forwards in time to Olaf and Inga's grandson. We're now generations down in present time. He's a middle-aged man who's trying to decide whether to take $2 million from a developer for this old farm, the same exact building whose history we just saw play out in your film. He ultimately decides he can't sell the place. But that seems like a happier ending than we might be seeing across the country.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, for me, it was less about farm economics today, and it was more about knowledge of stewardship of your heritage. And I think what he's saying is, I understand where I come from, as opposed to I want to keep farming.
You said the film is about love. What are you saying about this love? Again, it was a mail order bride, two people who didn't know each other, not a lot spoken between them, but something else, as you see, especially Inga as an older woman. I could never, if I were just to see this woman sitting in her little simple living room in Minnesota, I never would have guessed.
That's true of everyone, though. And I think we're too quick to say, oh, I don't want to talk to this person, or there's nothing there. I think everybody has a fascinating story. It may not be a big dramatic story like Britney Spears or Anna Nicole Smith, but I think Inga's story is interesting because she is what America is made of. And I think it's a little more of a contract for her, too, where she said, you know what? I'm here. I have nowhere else to go. I don't have any money to leave. I'm going to make this work.
Ali Salim, director of Sweetland, which just won the Independent Spirit Award for Best First Feature. To find out where you can see the film, go to our website, here-now.org. We highly recommend it. Ali, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.